Okay, I'm Rick Hansen. It's February 1st, 2017. And as I mentioned, we're exploring relationships this year. And I'm exploring whether my microphone. And I'm hearing that I see the red, so it's working. Okay, good. All right. So, I'm going to introduce this topic, a little exploration of what in psychology is called attachment theory. And apply that to the design. Might be very familiar material for some, not so familiar for others. I invite you to look at it through the lens of personal practice. And I want to introduce this topic, this idea that we form attachments to other people that can be very helpful. Attachment itself is not a problem. It's when we get caught up in craving in relationship to attachment. And in particular, in relationship to the objects of attachment, that we get into trouble. So this topic is very relevant because it plays out, attachments play out in different patterns in our relationships that affect us emotionally, psychologically, and can really stir up very powerful forms of craving, including forms that are rooted in the youngest, earliest, and deepest strata of the parfait of the mind, the layers of the mind. A story that might introduce this to you is has to do with my own family. Our son was born, and when he was really young, maybe a month or so old, my mom and dad came to visit. They were in Los Angeles, and my family and I were up in Sausalito at the time. And my mother, very loving person with a big personality, came into the room, wanted to see her grandson, just out of her mind and so excited. So I handed her to him, and she was cradling him, and she perched him on her ample bosom, which was sort of like the landing side of an aircraft carrier. This scratchy sweater, had big glasses, no longer alive, huge earrings. And she perched for us there. He couldn't hold his head up, so he kept trying to hold his head up to look at her. Ah, how are you? How are you? She's so excited about her grandson, her first grandchild. And he started to fuss, understandably, after 20, 30, for me, eternally, I'm painful, second. But for him, probably only a couple of dozen seconds. All right. So then he started to fuss, and I held my tongue for a while. And finally, I said to my mom, who was oblivious to all this, "Hey, Mom, you know, I think Forrest wants you to hold him to the side." And he was scared and crazy and all that. And she said, still really excited, "Oh, he doesn't know what he wants." Parenting principle number one: theory of childhood. And I said, "Well, I think he knows what he wants because he was really comfortable when he was being held this way. Now he's really uncomfortable that way. He's letting you know what he wants." And he said, "Oh, who cares what he wants?" Oh. Parenting principle number two: model of the child. So the first rule is kids don't really know what they want. They're not beings. They're just chaotic. And then second, even if they know what they want, it doesn't matter. And I murmured, "Well, you know, I care what he wants," and I retrieved him. My wife and dad was about to explode out of the line of sight of my mom. I figured it was definitely time to retrieve our son, and we kept going. And the point I'm trying to make with all this is not that my mom was bad in any way. She was raised that way. Child with depression, alcoholic father, chaotic family, traditional family structure. She was raised that way. It made sense for her to be that way. She was raised me as best she could that way. And so I evaded her control at a fairly early age by being perfect. Effective strategy, although you pay a price later, but anyway. But it has consequences. And right there, you can see a model of the orientation of adult caregivers who have incredible power relative to a very dependent. And as I talk here, I don't mean to be traumatized anymore, but to the extent you're comfortable with it, you may reflect on your own upbringing, as you can recall it, or as you can observe the residues left behind in your own body, in your own emotional basements, or as you can best surmise from what you know. Pretty likely a lot of what you experience as a kid. And when I say kid, you know, 0 to 18, the younger the years, usually the more comfortable, especially around relationships, early patterns. The second story I want to tell here as an introduction had to do with my dissertation, my doctoral dissertation. I did it on 15-month-olds, and I was very interested even then around, you could call it the socialization of desire, the training of wanting. How do we learn to want? How do we learn to want skillfully? What do the parents have to do with that? And I observed that one way to interact with kids is that everything's fine when parents and kids, adults and kids, all want the same thing. Where the rubber hits the road is when there's a collision of the wants of the child and the wants of the other people in the world. Then what happens? And I was very interested in the method that parents intuitively use, many of them had no research on it at all, of offering alternatives. The child has a problematic one. Instead of just punishing the child, thwarting the child, you let the child know that I get what you want, I care what you want, and here's something different. Not the steak knives, how about the spoons? Right? Switch in and get. Kind of gratifying form of control. Intersection of nurturing and authority. So I studied it and went into the homes of 20 mothers who were willing for me to do this because I was given a videotape of filmed interactions with their kid. Probably some of them burned the videotape later, but anyway. And after following them around the house for about 20 minutes, I had them make two batches of ginger snap cookies, which were designed with 15 months old to create a lot of collision. I observed two things in particular. The first was a disconnect between words and deeds. There were parents who would speak kind of gruffly about how they were raising their kids, being kind of tough, and who were really sensitive, really human, really nurturing, really responsive, really able to kind of flow with the wants of the child in a very skillful way. And there were other parents who could really talk the talk. They had attachment theory down, they could really do the lingo, they were subscribing to Mothering Magazine, they were deep in the weeds of the whole ideology. But when you watch what their hand did, when that kid reached for a little spoon, that would be perfectly fine for that child to use. And without even looking at the child, it took the child's hand away. You knew something else. So the real question is, all these little moments, what's actually happening? And, for example, research on toddlers and preschoolers, we were all once toddlers and preschoolers, says that on average, about every 3 minutes, there's a control episode between parent and child, on average. Sometimes they're coming every 3 seconds. Sometimes it's every minute or two. Just imagine now, as an adult, you're in a work environment or any other setting, and 20 times an hour, someone makes you do something you don't want to do or is unresponsive and doesn't help you when you need their assistance to do something you do want to do. That's the average. That's the average for a typical, in a variety of studies, it's about average for a typical American preschooler or toddler. And in a lot of those studies, it shows that roughly about half of those episodes are unnecessary. They could have just let things unfold. Nothing would have been harmed. No major standard would have been violated. It would have been okay. So the second point about the dissertation was that these little things add up. Big events matter, but the gradual accumulation of the relational history that we all experience in the matrix of early childhood. In utero to some extent, especially after we were born, those little moments really add up over time. And when you're videotaping, and then having to analyze the videotape and code it and segment it and sort it and show that offering alternatives reduces negative affect and increases compliance, which is good, right? And the world's expert on this one very narrow thing. You know, when you watch that much videotape, you really see all these little things happen on a time scale of seconds or half seconds that really affect kids. So all of that history that we experienced when we were young, vulnerable, when we were designed to be affected by our experience, especially negative, or just negativity, all those little experiences have consequences. And in terms of what's called attachment theory, those consequences sort into four major patterns of relating. These are modes of relating. They're forms of relating. And you might see for yourself where you plausibly felt with your major relationship with your child and where things are today. There's more in the mix than the interactivity between the child and caregivers. The child's temperament comes into play, medical issues. The child is an active participant in the process. But I'm going to focus here on the impact of interactivity in particular. Another important point is that we can have different patterns of relationship with different people. Research shows that the attachment relationship that a young child might have to, let's say, a mother and a father are independent of each other. We can also form attachment relationships or patterns of relating, relationship paradigms, you might call them. Sometimes in psychoanalysis, they're called object relations, our relations to different objects. We can form them to groups of people. I, for example, had strong, securely attached relationships with individual friends, but in groups, I was really nervous for a long time. You can also have different relationships to classes of people, to men, to women, to authority figures, to young people, to old people. Okay? The basic patterns fall into four categories. First one is securely attached. There can still be issues, but deep in the core of the child expects that caregivers, let's say, or the one to whom the child is attached, will be emotionally available, will be attuned, reasonably responsive, reasonably consistent, not necessarily perfect, but there's a sense of trustworthiness and stability in that relationship. Because there is that sense of stability, there's a kind of secure base there from which the child can explore. The more secure the base, the more the child can pull wheelies, try new things, dare greatly, as Brené Brown puts it, dream bigger dreams. Okay? Then there are three kinds of insecure attachment. The first is called avoidant, in which a child or an adult, let's say, tries to preserve an optimal distance. Not too close, not too far away. It's a mode of relating, although it might look very distancing. In a typical research paradigm called the strange situation, the stranger situation, either way, let's imagine an 18-month-old who's avoidantly attached at that point, being hooked up to little measures of physiology and observed through a one-way mirror. The way the research paradigm works is that, let's say it's a parent, could be a mother or father, with the child. Then the researcher comes in, takes the caregiver out. After a little bit of time, caregiver comes back in and they see what happens. An avoidantly attached child will typically be very well behaved, kind of off to the side of the parent, allowed to relate as long as the child's not too much trouble. Parent leaves, child looks oblivious, but the measures of heart rate, galvanic skin response on the skin, wow, the needle just flies to the peg. The child internally has a strong reaction, but doesn't show it, because that would seem demanding. And demands, bids for contact, are typically dismissed in various ways, either ignored or even punished. This child is trained now into being avoidant. Then, parent goes away, kid's heartbeats, starts settling down some, parent comes back, child doesn't fuss, no problem, wow, physiology spikes again. Whoa! But it doesn't, you know, there's no burden on the parent, no demand. Optimal distance. That's a kind of paradigm of avoidant attachment. Then there's another kind, has different names. People often call it insecure anxious. Basically, it's a situation where a child is both clinging and fussing and reproachful, but doesn't trust the parent to deliver the goods. And so this is a child who often is very vigilant, really tracking the caregiver. You never know if they're going to be there or not. Often it's a caregiver who's emotionally unstable themselves, often a caregiver who's quite narcissistically involved themselves and preoccupied. When that sort of caregiver leaves, the child fusses, and can't be soothed. Caregiver comes back, child protests, often is angry, a clinging reproach. Bad mommy, bad mommy, bad mommy, don't go, bad mommy. Okay? And is often inconsolable. Hard to settle the child. Anxious. Then there's a fourth type of attachment, third insecure attachment style type. It's pretty rare, but it's present. It's called disorganized. These are kids often who are raised in really chaotic, terrible environments, often physiologically disturbed, drug-addicted mothers, kids in orphanages where there's minimal contact and care. They're just disorganized. They just fall apart. The worst thing to see when you're with young children is despair. I saw that in some situations when I was videotaping, where a kid just protests, tries, does everything, and just finally kind of falls back in the high chair, disorganized and despairing, and dejected and slumping at 15 months. You don't want to see that. I'm trying not to traumatize you, but I'm probably doing that. Oh well, sorry. Okay, so what do we make of all this, right? I'm kind of sketching models, and like all patterns, there are blurred boundaries between the types. It's more complicated than that, okay? And there's a lot of hope here, because we can grow and learn. But one of the fundamental foundations, really, of Buddhist practice is about dispelling ignorance. It's about clear seeing. It's about knowing. It's about presence. It's about illusion, delusion, falling away, recognizing what's really there. So it's very helpful to recognize these patterns of relationship in our history and in the depths of our mind and how they might be affecting us today. And it's really helpful to track some of these dynamics in present time. Because with mindfulness and with different practices of virtue and wisdom, we can help ourselves with these patterns and we can help others. Because when you see it in another person, suddenly it becomes less personal. You start realizing, oh, that's why you're so aggravated, or to me, you know what I mean? Or, oh, that's why it's so hard for you to get that I do love you and it's not a big deal here. You know, like, oh, or oh, I see. It's because you're so affected. Remember that avoidantly attached child? This physiology just hits the roof without an outward display because that child is so affected by relatedness, right? And you realize that avoidant person is your 45-year-old engineering husband, and you realize, oh, it's not that my husband has I'm using this deliberately, has a stone for a heart. It's because he's affected so much by me that he's doing this kind of distancing, if that's true. It could be a helpful way to understand it. So I just want to call out a couple of things and then, you know, kind of open it up, hear what you make of all this, okay? So one thing to call out it is to watch yourself in the dance of intimacy. Are you stepping in or stepping back? Neither is right, neither is wrong, neither is good, neither is bad. They're just moves. But you can watch yourself in short time scales or longer time scales. Are you getting closer? For example, are you becoming more revealed? If they say something to you that's on the self-disclosure scale, 0 to 10, if they venture to offer a 1, do you meet their 1 or do you stay at 0? If they escalate, and which is a bid for contact, they move one step toward you, they go up to a 1 or a 2 and you stay at a 0, that's a dismissal. That's a communication. No, I don't want to go there. I want to stay here. Now, maybe you ought to do that. Again, not good, not bad, but dispelling illusion, dispelling delusion, dispelling ignorance, clear seeing, mindfulness. Are you doing it deliberately? Is it skillful and benevolent to act in that way, including benevolent toward yourself? And you can watch that movement, closeness, distancing. Number of mechanisms of distancing, intellectualizing, picking little quarrels, relating through bickering. That's a form of optimal distance. Being oblivious to the bid for contact of the other person. Ignoring appeals for narcissistic supplies. In other words, others may be kind of pulling for empathic attunement, mirroring. They might be pulling for praise, pulling for acknowledgement, pulling for appreciation, pulling for recognition of their role, their efforts, their sacrifices, their own pains. They might be pulling for that, right? Then what do? Do we step into it, even if that's not our first instinct for whatever reasons, and meet them where they are and be appropriately responsive? Or do we not even recognize the signal? Or if we actually do recognize it, we automatically do a little bit of distancing, push them away. So watching that movement, and there are many forms of it. Stepping in, stepping back, closer, farther, how do we do that? Second is to watch how we do to ourselves what others did to us when we were young. Do we have a dismissive approach to our own vulnerability, our own messy interior, our softer, more embarrassing, not all put together feelings and desires? Are we dismissive like a parent? Alternately, do we flick back and forth between indulging those parts of ourselves in a very permissive way and then alternating over to harsh scolding and scathing criticism? How do we relate to ourselves? What do we relate to ourselves as a parent attempts to promote a particular relationship? With the quality of nurturance, steadiness, a little bit of advice, no, not the chainsaw, about the plastic spoons, right? You've had enough cookies for now, you're not a bad girl, that enough cookies for boy, I thought, do we relate to ourselves in that way or not, right? How do you relate to yourself? And then the last thing is, how do we respond to people who are kind of messily attached? They're not all put together. They might stir up our own reactions. How do we find ways to, be solid and healthy and appropriate ourselves with people who are, just really insecure or people who are really avoidant and distancing? How do we deal with those other types with insight and recognition? All right. I hope I haven't stirred up a whole bunch of neurotic, creepy crawlers, under the stones, but okay. Questions or comments?
Yeah, could you bring
I'll bring some ginger cookies next time. It's really good. Yes, please. Yeah.
Of different styles. So if a child was raised in an overlapped situation, does that mean that the child was even more complicated to treat or double messed up?
Right. Okay. So it's a great question. So these are four styles, and this is not for me. I'm just kind of the messenger of attachment theory. So, and it's good to look it up, Wikipedia. You know, it's interesting. Then your comment was, what happens if your person's raised in a combination of styles? And you often will get that. Like one parent will be will be loving, but distancing. A little clue about myself, my style growing up was insecure, avoidant. I learned early on that the way to, you know, get my needs met with my parents was to not cause them trouble and to not ask for too much and not get my hopes up. And, you know, and then I've had to kind of deal with that over on in my life. But a person could have one parent who's more distancing. They're loving, but they're distancing, with another parent who kind of flips back and forth between too close and then, you know, napalm landing on you. So what do you do then? Bad news, you got more to deal with. Good news, you have more flexible relationship styles. You know how to relate to more different kinds of people because you have different access to different kinds of things. And you're, I think, are getting at as well that, you know, these patterns often are combinations, right? What I invite you to have mindfulness for throughout this whole year-long exploration of relationships, and especially about this, is to really have mindfulness for the deepest longings of your heart. Longings that feel right at your core, that feel young, maybe longings that have a lot of charge around them, including shame related to those longings, or internal punishment about being needy, for example. Those longings can take this pretty intellectual roadmap that I've just kind of laid out as an entry into this territory, and it gets very visceral. Very visceral and powerful. Okay. A key going forward is when a person has healthy experiences of relatedness with a reasonably stable other, someone who is, in terms of the type of relationship you have, they're basically reliable. They have goodwill for you. You matter to them inside the frame of that relationship, whatever it is. And there's a reasonable amount of empathy. There's a reasonable amount of negotiating and, you know, provision of what you need. It feels good with that person. It could be with your pet. It could be with someone that you are caring for, but it's a good feeling, has a healthy feeling. Bring a big spoon. Really take it in. That's the primary pathway to secure attachment. The internalization of healthy relationship experiences, particularly along with a kind of clear-eyed understanding of what happened to you as a child, so you can form a what's called a coherent narrative about it as an adult. Right? So that's full of opportunity. So hear me there. Take in the good of healthy relationship experiences and help them sink down to and connect with those younger wounded layers. And second, you know, form a kind of coherent understanding of what happened that normalizes it, makes sense out of it, really claims for yourself the impact of what happened to you. Got those two things? Right. Okay, great. Other questions or comments? Great.
So earlier you said, talked about attachment and craving.
Yeah.
And so attachment sounds like healthy needs that yeah. you can express. Yeah. Whereas craving for the attachments can
yeah.
create problems. So how does that relate to, can you enlarge on that as to how that relates to intimacy?
Yeah, it's a great question, isn't it? So what's the difference, let's say, in psychology or in Buddhism between attachment in an intimate relationship and craving, right? I had friends who loved each other dearly, and when they parted, I found out in the morning in an ordinary way, when they were a heterosexual couple, one would go off to work here, one would go off to work there, they would do the usual, bye honey, kiss, something. And they would take a moment, a few seconds usually, to register the truth that they may not see the other person ever again. Not morbidly, but owning the truth of it, the reality of it. So for me, that's an example of attachment without craving. They loved each other dearly. They were not in denial about how much it would hurt to lose them. Later on, one of them did pass away, and you know, I was at the memorial service for that person, and it was very clear that her partner, who I knew well too, was deeply moved and grieving the loss. In a, as the Buddha would put it, first start kind of way. It was a raw experience. It was very real. But it was held in a frame of continuous letting go, continual letting go. So I, for me, that's the key distinction, is their lovingness, and is there also a reasonable amount of sticking up for your own needs and asking the other person to give you what you need, which might have to do with them stretching a little bit or, you know, being kind to your neurosis. I say that to my wife, in effect. Honey, she's not as neurotic as I am. She was one of those rare people raised in a holy, benign family environment with a great childhood. I say, you know, be nice to my neurosis, right? It's kind of like that. There's a place for that. But on the other hand, do we get caught up in insistence, drivenness, you know, missing sight of the prize for the sake of some narrow gain? You know, that's craving. And you can feel it. Do you feel the tension in your body? Do you feel the drivenness? Also, frankly, are there negative emotions that carry you away? Not just arise and they're there and you kind of work with them and they pass on through, but as the Buddha put it, do they invade the mind and remain? That's where we get in trouble. Anger, resentment, bitterness, grievances piling up. You know, when you're, are you making a case internally? You know, accusations. Build a particular, you know, bullet point checklist of your partner's failings. Speak from some experience there. You know, then you're in trouble. Yeah. One last?
With this caregiver early on, I'm assuming doesn't necessarily have to be the mother.
Right.
It could be the grandmother,
yeah.
Or it could be
big sister, big brother, sometimes, yeah.
As long as there's somebody there.
Yeah.
Right. I just wanted to double check that.
Oh, yeah. One of the very hopeful things, is that, as was found in, has been found in many studies, including one in particular, so... I think it was Kauai, the island of Kauai, in Hawaii, what happened was that all the kids who were born in 1 year were followed for like 20 years to see what happened and to see what affected things. So there are a lot of factors there. You have to be a little cautious in the conclusions you draw. But they were particularly interested in children from really, really tough environments, tough home environments, where I think there needed to be at least one, if not two out of three conditions of mental, in the parent, mental illness, drugs and alcohol, and poverty. You know, really tough environments. I'm pretty close to right on that. And then they studied them, and then they really investigated the kids who seemed to turn out okay nonetheless. You know, a lot of strikes against them, a lot of difficult situations. They still turned out okay. And they interviewed them, and the stories varied widely, but there was one common factor. And every one of the children who was able to cope with, it was kind of bumpy maybe, And maybe there was some insecure attachment on the way, but they finally got themselves to a soft landing toward the end of adolescence into early adulthood. The one factor that was across the board was that someone in their life saw the good in them and believed in them. It could have been a baseball coach, could have been a rabbi, could have been a relative, could have been someone. But someone, and it didn't need to have been a continuous relationship, but someone saw the good. And I think, you know, someone was for them a vision of what was possible in terms of a healthy, good relationship.
Super quick, for any of the group that has a need to see a great illustration of that and hasn't read Hillbilly Elegy,
oh, okay.
Totally recommend, because that's exactly the story.
Yeah.
The grandmother is the one that really straightens out the kid.
Yeah. So maybe to finish up here, if I could, I better keep going and end on time, partly because I have to drive to Santa Cruz tomorrow morning in the rain, so I need to be alert. Takeaways. It's easy to spin out about all this and have it be really abstract or intellectual or, you know, what about and all that. It's so helpful just to bring it right down. How can you help yourself carry your security with you wherever you go? So even if you're with people who themselves are not very reliable or who themselves are not really prepared for a reciprocal, appropriate level of intimacy relationship, in any setting, including at work, no matter what's out there, can you help yourself become increasingly secure in your own core? Increasingly clear about what happened, how it affected you, and how you can work with it, and increasingly stable in a sense of kind of calm lovingness in your being, no matter what's out there. Can you help yourself become, establish more of a secure base inside yourself, bit by bit, by internalizing experiences of healthy relatedness? And second, can you do that for others? As the Buddha said, can you give no person cause to fear you? Can you be securely available, reliably available, as appropriate to other people? Can you give them the experience that they, as vulnerable, rattled, neurotic beings just like you, that they have been received in you? Their message in a bottle has landed on the shores of your heart. Okay. How about we sit for a minute and finish up? Be at peace. Take care. See you in a few weeks.